Bonjour and bienvenue to Lulabelle's Francophiles. Je m'appelle Lou, and this is the place to come to keep your Frenchy vibes aflutter and help you to lose yourself in France without even leaving home. In each episode, we chat about our French experiences with guests who live in Australia, France, and right around the world, and we share ideas for how to stay connected to the Francophile within you. Alors, today my guest is someone who has numerous fabulous stories to tell, both French and otherwise. Laura Morelli is an art historian with a PhD from Yale. She is a best-selling and award-winning historical novelist, in addition to authoring numerous guidebooks for travellers. And she's lived in five countries. Bienvenue to Lulabelle's Francophiles, Laura. Bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, bonjour, ça va très bien. Merci, et toi?
Ça va bien, merci. So, Laura, there is so much to unpack with your story that I'm actually not sure where to start. Perhaps the first way I felt a gorgeous connection with you was the highlighting of Venice on your website. I know that this is a podcast about France, but I don't know any Francophiles who don't love Venice as well. So tell me about your first experience there.
Well, I live in the United States, but I was very fortunate as a preteen to travel to Europe for the first time. And I remember being in St. Mark's Square in Venice, and my friend and I fell prey to a fast-talking hawker in the Piazza San Marco, and he lured us to the glass island of Murano, where we were deposited directly into a line of tourists at a glass factory. And we walked in and were surrounded by tourists, of course, and I came out disheveled and a little bewildered, but I had a beautiful little glass fish to show for it, and I still have it, actually, and it's a testament to this experience from long ago. But, you know, even though it was a bewildering experience, it sparked curiosity for me about the artistic traditions of the world, because here I was a little, you know, girl raised on a farm in Georgia, and I already had an idea in my head that I was supposed to go home with Murano glass, but right. I had no idea why or what it was or why it was important. And, you know, but it was the beginning of an odyssey for me to explore the history of art.
I have to just let you in on a little snippet of information. I have right here on my desk Murano glass that I keep with me at all times, that I love. And it's a tiny little glass bead with flowers that have somehow come through the glass. It's quite exquisite. And I have it next to me all the time to remind me of the wonderful places that we're still going to be able to travel in the future. So what a gorgeous introduction to Venice and to Europe. So was that your first trip over there? Did you go to France then as well?
I did, and I still have a hilarious photo of a 12-year-old me standing in front of the facade of Notre Dame in Paris. And, you know, that too was really a coup de foudre, you know, just a lightning clap, a thunderclap, standing there and looking at that marvelous building. And I just knew that there was something there that was missing in the new world, you know, something from long ago. And as I said, it just, that trip sparked a curiosity that fueled into a passion eventually and led to my graduate studies in art history.
Being from Australia, similarly to America, we have a wonderfully rich Indigenous history that goes back tens of thousands of years. But the Western impact on our history is fairly recent, and it's so different when you go to Europe and see that history that goes back for hundreds and thousands of years, more than ours. I agree. It really touches something that we can't really quite explain. So I understand that connection, and I see it when I look at your works as well, that connection to the oldness of the world is wonderful. You live on the eastern side of the US now, and you've
That's right.
got four kids and a number of fur babies, and you've got a family there who presumably share your passion for wanting to travel back to these places. Does that make it easier for you?
Oh, yes. I don't know that it makes it easy, but my family does love to travel. My oldest child was actually born in Italy, and they really do appreciate the opportunities to travel and learn languages and learn about these different cultures. And I think as a young person, it's such a great time to be able to travel and explore.
So you've obviously been back to France often since that first time, and I have done a little research on you before I chat, knew that you'd lived there at one point. So tell me about that time.
Well, I started out studying when I got back from that trip when I was 12 years old and went on in school. I immediately took whatever French classes I could, and I ended up being Madame la Présidente of my French club in high school. And I had a wonderful teacher who was just a very, you know, passionate speaker and teacher of French. And so she really encouraged me. After that, I studied Romance languages in college. My dad always said that I was focused more on the romance than the languages part of that degree. But there you have it. I studied as an exchange student at the University of Lyon. Went back for my graduate studies and spent a lot of time in Paris and traveling in the countryside. I lived with an elderly couple in Normandy for a few months, and that was really fascinating because they were actually part of the French resistance when the Allies landed on their beaches. Little did I know how significant their stories would end up being for me later as a historical novelist. But at the time, you know, it was just a fascinating time to sit around the dinner table and hear about their life and their past and those stories. There was even an American living in their village. I was doing some research for a thesis, and it was a tiny little village, and there was an American man there that they promptly introduced me to, and he had actually landed on the Normandy beaches and fell in love with a French woman from this little village, and he never went back to America. Really? And so the two of them were fabulous because they spoke Franglais, you know, just half French, half English, and because she didn't speak any English when they met and he didn't speak any French, and yet they fell in love and he stayed there for the rest of his life, which is such a great love story.
Oh, that is just a divine story. I love that. Well, most French-obsessed people I know speak about their love of museums and art, as well as clearly those kinds of stories that you've just told. But they talk about what they like to see when they visit Paris and sometimes also broader France. How did your passion for art history start? Because I'm hearing about your passion for human story and wanting to pass that on. But what about the art side?
Well, really, when I started studying in college and especially in graduate school, that's when I really began to pursue art history, because I realized, I think, inherently that art history is really about stories and people. It's about the stories of and the legacies of these objects that are so fascinating. And so I pursued a PhD in art history with the intention of being an art history professor. And I did teach at the college level in the U.S. And in Rome. But, you know, it was still those stories behind the works of art that pulled at me. And I realized one day when I was sitting in the back row of an academic conference listening to someone drone on about a work of art, I thought, wow, how did we art historians, you know, take the most fascinating subject in the entire world and make it dull and inaccessible, you know? Yes. And so I thought there's something wrong here. And I feel compelled to bring this sort of that spark of passion and fascination and curiosity that I felt as a young person looking at art objects and learning about them. And so that's what I try to do today with my online students and with my readers, is to kind of open that world and immerse people in art history in a way that, you know, is not hopefully dull and dry and inaccessible.
No, I agree. With regard to French artists, I'm probably going to ask a ridiculously broad question, but what are your thoughts? Do you have a favorite French artist or a favorite French museum?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. It would be hard to narrow it down.
Very broad.
You know, I love, of course, the Louvre is one of my favorite places. And every time I go to the Louvre, one of the first galleries I go to is the David Gallery. I think it's just the size and the scale of those Napoleonic paintings by Jacques-Louis David that are so impressive. It's just a fantastic gallery. And I love the French Renaissance. I think those paintings are weird and fascinating.
Yes.
There's a lot to unpack there in the 16th, 15th and 16th century in French painting. Mm. There's no place like the Louvre, of course. You could spend the rest of your life there and still not see everything.
Oh, absolutely. Your latest book, The Stolen Lady, is being released on the 21st of September. And I'm fascinated by the concept of this story of two women being separated by 500 years, but both being connected to the infamous artwork that's at the Louvre of Leonardo da Vinci, the Mona Lisa. So tell me a bit about this intriguing story.
So The Stolen Lady is a dual timeline historical novel, and in part it takes place in Florence, Italy, around the turn of the 16th century when Leonardo da Vinci painted the wife of this prosperous cloth trader, who later became known as the Mona Lisa. And then on the other hand, it follows the story of Anne Guichard, who is a young archivist assistant at the Louvre. And she is one of the Louvre staff tasked with this almost impossible task of packing up the Louvre's collection of some close to 4,000 objects and spiriting them away into hiding places in the French countryside as the Nazis are about to arrive on French soil. And I wanted to connect the two main characters of the story, one being Anne, the other being Bellina, who is a sort of a gullible servant in Lisa's household. I wanted to connect the two women through this painting of the Mona Lisa. And so that's the painting is really at the heart of the story, and it's the thread that pulls these two women together in time.
I had a podcast chat with Claudine Hemingway a few months ago. She's also an historian, and she often has a focus on women and their role in art. And she and I talked about Rose Valland, who saved much of the art in the Louvre in World War II, enabling it to be found after the war. I'm fascinated by those real life stories. And just you talking about these two stories, I can imagine their real life as it took place in those times. They're sometimes more interesting than fiction that's created. I'm not sure that Rose had an impact on the saving the actual Mona Lisa, but did her real life story have an impact on your novel, The Stolen Lady, at all?
Well, yes, in so much as, if you go and read the primary accounts, which I always do when I start a historical novel, I always try to go back to what people wrote at the time. And there were a lot of women actually employed in the French and Parisian museums. Rose Valland was at the Jeu de Paume. But at the Louvre, there were many high-ranking women in curatorial positions, in archival positions, who had direct influence, direct control over the safekeeping of these treasures from the Louvre. And one of the most fascinating is a woman named Lucie Mazorik, and she was the wife of André Chanson, who was much more famous. He was a prize-winning novelist, and he himself was also a Louvre employee, but Lucy actually wrote down the story of their exodus from Paris with trucks loaded down with these gigantic paintings, as I just described, by Jacques-Louis David, these massive canvases, some rolled up, some simply chucked into the back of a truck bed and driven off into the countryside to, first they went to the Chateau of Chambord, but then later they went to privately owned castles and monasteries in the countryside in an effort to keep them out of Nazi hands. Mm. And so it was primary sources like that, diaries and memoirs of these Louvre employees, many of them women, that were really at the base of my research for this story. So Rose Villain was an incredible heroine. I mean, what she did saved so many works of art and brought them back to Paris. But she actually wasn't the only one.
No, their stories just move me so greatly. I think they are such brave, brave women to have done what they did in that time. So I know your novels are based around those true stories of art history through time. But with your historical fiction, do you first find the character and then build the story around them? Or do you find the period of history that you want to immerse yourself in and search for a true story to work with?
So very often for me, what comes first is either the setting or a single work of art. And then the characters sort of emerge from the yeah. soup, from the darkness, they come out. But often, very often, it's a setting or a particular work of art. So, for example, my novel, The Gondola Maker, takes place in a gondola making boat yard in Venice in the 16th century. And, you know, as soon as I had this this boat yard in my brain, then suddenly the gondola maker and his family emerged. You know, I wrote another book called The Giant, which is the story behind the making of Michelangelo's David. Well, obviously, Michelangelo is a character, but he's actually not the main character in the book. But what came first there was the sculpture itself, the great colossal sculpture of the David. So very often, you know, it's a place or, you know, in this case, the Mona Lisa, that's sort of the center of the story. And then everything else sort of comes together around it.
Yeah. Well, you have an online art academy, and I imagine you're busier now than you've ever been in this COVID period when so much of our life has turned to being online. How do you think in the future, people that are working as we are and working as you are as historical novelists, how do you think they'll view this period in history that we're living through?
It's such a good question. It's something I think about a lot, and I wish I had a great, smart answer. I don't know yet.
I think about it quite often too, about how will they think of us? What will they write about us?
Yeah. And, you know, part of me thinks that we're not going back ever to the way we were. We've gone so far so quickly in the last 18 months that I feel like the shift is somehow going to endure with us. You know, very quickly, we've all gotten great at using Zoom. I mean, here are, you know, you and I, you're in Australia, I'm in America. It's tomorrow where you are. We're not even on the same date. And yet we're, you know, we're having this conversation. And I have had some really fabulous experiences with my colleagues in Europe during the pandemic. I've started doing virtual visits for my students into museums and archaeological sites. And the amazing thing is that a lot of them have been closed when we've done these virtual visits. So imagine going into a museum with no one there. I mean, it's like a dream. You know, people would love to go into a closed museum. I certainly would love to go into a museum with no one there. And so this period of time has allowed us certain access to things and access to people that we might never have come across before. And so I think that's really a hidden blessing of this very challenging time.
I agree. I was going to ask you, in times when travel isn't such a challenge, do you try and get back to all the museums and galleries of Europe, and in particular France, that are closed right now? But I think you're right. I think you can actually visit some of these places online. But when we do get to go back in person, the old-fashioned way, what is your favourite either museum or gallery to go to? And it doesn't have to be France. I know Francophiles will be happy to hear tips to go anywhere at the moment. Where would you want to go to first?
So when I was a college student, I think I mentioned to you, I studied abroad for a year at the University of Lyon, and I have not been back to Lyon in many years, but I loved living there. And one thing I really appreciated about Lyon was at the time there were no visitors. It was very much a commercial city. Even though it was very historic and there are Roman ruins and medieval ruins.
And the Traboules.
The Traboules, very interesting city. But there were no international visitors back then. And I'm sure it's changed, but I didn't have any money to eat well back then. I think I lived on frites most of the time, but you know, Lyon is the gastronomic capital of France. And so I would love to go back and have a good meal there. But there's also a wonderful art museum with some really interesting and different paintings and other works of art. So I would love to go back to the art museum in Lyon sometime in the near future on my next trip to Europe. And I recommend it. It's a very interesting museum.
Oh, I will take that recommendation. My very last podcast episode, actually, the one that was just released before this, was about Lyon. And I haven't been there, but my father, who I inherited much of my love of France from, he recommends it's one of his favorite places. My French teacher, it's her favorite place. Everybody says, oh, you must go to Lyon. And I'm so enamored by the whole feel of the place without having been there. So I'm with you. I'm going to meet you there. That's our next go-to place the minute we can get out of here.
Let's do it. It's halfway.
That's right. Oh, wait. So you have written a number of shopper's guides, including one for France, that list all of my favorite artisans' traditions, including parfum, there's Limoges porcelain, pottery, handmade Parisian umbrellas. I'm intrigued by that. Baccarat, crystal, chocolate, just so much more. Now, it's organized into regions, which for an obsessive traveler like myself is brilliant. How did you do the research for that book? Was that just from living there? And I'm hoping you got to spend years in France going from village to village, although I'm sure the reality is not so romantic as that.
Well, actually, I did live in France for 4 years. I did pound quite a bit of pavement while I was there. And, you know, what's crazy to me now when I look back is that when I was working on my books Made in France and Made in Italy, the internet was in its infancy. And so literally the only way to find people was to look in the phone directory, you know, or just walk through a town. I mean, you know, I think those of us who were born, you know, after the advent of the internet, the digital natives have no concept of what that was like, but it really was pounding the pavement and walking into these little shops and talking with people. And, you know, in the intervening years, of course, I've updated everything with the websites that have come online, even the small mom and pop artisans now have a website, but so things have been updated over time, but it was really a wonderful experience to do that research. For sure. You know, I think when you get the chance to go and meet artisans face to face, it's one of the most immersive travel experiences you can have. I mean, you can really hear and experience someone else's passion for what they do. And you might go home with a souvenir that has a lot of meaning because you've met the person who made it, whether it's a handmade umbrella, like you mentioned, or a piece of jewelry. You know, I have some little things. I have a Limoges box. I have some jewelry. I have things that I've bought in France. And when I pull them out, it brings me a lot of joy because I remember the person connected with it and the story of how it was made.
Oui, d'accord. I have a little umbrella that I so treasure that is ridiculous now I think about it because it's just an ordinary pop-up umbrella, but I bought it at the Galerie Lafayette and it just, to me, it reminds me of a wonderful day that I spent in Paris. But I'm going to hunt out from your list the handmade umbrella artisan because that to me would be a treasure that I would just adore. I just love those quirky kinds of things to bring back. And I often go when I go overseas or when I go to France, I go knowing what one piece I'm going to be looking for, and I'll take a piece of luggage that I know is going to fit that. So I'll take a tube that's from the Australia Post to fit particular things that I'm going to be rolling up to go in there. So then I can pack whatever it is that's precious to be able to bring it home with me. So I'm going to be looking at your book and working out which particular item I want on my next trip and then bring that back with me.
Yeah, you're very smart to plan it in advance. And, you know, that's one thing I recommend to people. If you've got a soft-sided bag that you can stuff in your, an empty right. one you can stuff in your suitcase to bring things home. Or I always used to pack plastic Ziploc bags yes. or bubble wrap or things like that if I knew I wanted to bring home something fragile.
Right.
So it's good to strategize it in advance if you can.
Yeah. And then there's always going to be those wonderful little things that you'll find in a petite village in a corner of one of the magazines, and you think, well, I cannot go without that piece. So, you know, there's always going to be something that's just a found object on your travels, which will always remind you of that place. But it's
of
good
course.
To plan for some of those things you know you're going to want. And that's where I think your book is really fabulous, because you can actually plan ahead for some things, and that leaves enough room for the extra little surprises along your way. Now, if you were traveling back to France now, I know that you'd love to go back to the gallery in Lyon, but what would be a place that you'd be bursting to visit that potentially you haven't been before?
Oh, let's see. Let me think about this a second.
Well, you can have been there before.
I think for art and history, I really love this tour of Gothic architecture across the north of France. So if you think about, if you love cathedrals like I do, you know, there's not only Notre Dame, but if you think about Rouen, Reims, Strasbourg, these wonderful cathedrals across northern France, you could do a really great itinerary of those cathedrals dating from, you know, the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s. There's some beautiful buildings across Northern Europe. Amiens is one.
Amiens I just loved. I was astounded by how much they could do back in that period where they started building those without the technology that we have now. Just
it's incredible, really.
Isn't it? I find it astonishing. Well, this is a question I always ask every guest to Little Bell's Francophiles podcast. What would be your fave food to dive into the minute you get back to France?
Oh, well, when I lived in Paris, I was in the 7e arrondissement, just basically at the foot of the Eiffel Tower. And there used to be a little boulangerie there where they had the very delicious warm croissant au beurre, or they would make those baguettes that were oh so crunchy on the outside and soft and warm on the inside. And I would walk down and get that for breakfast every day. And I'd either have a croissant au beurre, or I would bring the baguette home and have it with some really nice salty French butter and jam. And I miss it so much. I'd love to go back there and have that. It's hard to beat French bread.
No, absolutely. That sounds fabulous. I have just ordered a wonderful advent calendar from a French online product specialist called France at Home. And each day there's a little window in the calendar to open with a jar of bon moment confiture or jam. And they have these wonderfully quirky flavors that I've only ever seen in France. So I might share a recipe on the Little Bells Francophiles website for making French jam at home with our Francophiles listeners, because I think we've had croissant and bread before, but the confiture, it's very special. And while people have got time, while they're in lockdown around the world, there are, not everywhere, of course, but where they are, they've got time to make jam. So it's probably a great time.
That calendar sounds fantastic. I'll have to look for that.
I'll put the link for that on the website as well, because it is just the most beautiful little gift that keeps on giving. And every day you open and they're really little, they're enough to put jam on about three or four slices of baguette, and they are just the most exquisite flavors, really different and lovely flavors. Yes. So I'll put the link on for that too, and you will love it. I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Sounds wonderful.
Yes. So something else I often ask is, what would be your perfect French day? You've already told us about quite a number of days that sound perfect to me, but is there any particular feel for a day that you could share with us that would help us see your perfect French day?
Well, I would definitely start with breakfast at the boulangerie that I mentioned. Yeah. And then, you know, it would definitely be an art-related or architecture-related day. I mean, I love the museums in Paris. Have you visited the Quai Branly Museum of African and Oceanic Art in Paris yet?
No, I haven't. And that's actually on my list. That's on my list. And I've actually watched Monty Don's episode recently. He does French-themed shows at times, and he talked about the Quai Branly, and it's just, yes, I must go there.
It's one of the newest museums in Paris, and it's very well done, and they have a nice restaurant on the roof with a great view of the city. So it's a great place to go and have lunch or dinner after you've walked through the museum.
They have a rooftop garden, I think, too, don't they, there?
They do, yes.
I think that's where he was shooting from. I think that's what the discussion was about, now I recall. Now, I always share some music on the Little Bells Francophiles podcast, and today, in honour of the fact that we spoke earlier about women in French art with Rose Villon, and obviously the infamous Mona Lisa, I'd like to share some music that is new by two Australian women who have wonderful music careers going back some time, but are now part of a duo named Baby A Lulu and are singing the most treble beautiful French songs. Is that okay with you?
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So they have a number of gorgeous tunes, but the one I'm sharing today is doing what we'd all love to be doing right now, celebrating Cette Nuit, and especially in France. So merci for your time today, Laura. I've loved escaping momentarily to France with you. You've really made me feel like I've been on a little vacance for a short period.
Well, thank you. It's thank you. This lovely. Has been so much fun for me too.
Way. And I'll be immersing myself in more of your books now too, to escape to Venice as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, they've really, I think, helped transport us in a way that is quite difficult at the moment in the world. So thank you for what you do. It's really special.
Oh, thank you very much for taking the time. And if your listeners want to learn more, they can just go to lauramorelli.com. You'll see all the books and courses and everything there.
Oh, absolutely. Tout à fait. And I'll have all of the links to things that we've spoken about today on the Little Bells Francophiles website. So they'll be able to follow into your website from there and be able to immerse themselves in your world of historical France, Venice, and everywhere else in your beautiful imagination.
Thank you so much.
So here is Baby et Lulu avec their song from their recent 2021 album, simply titled Album Toi. This is Cette Nuit. Au revoir, Laura, et bon journée.
Au revoir, merci.
Les puissantes lumières de la scène, avec nos talents hauts et nos robes à foufou, nous vous offrons le meilleur de nous-mêmes. Mais cette nuit, il y a un secret que je voudrais révéler. Il s'est caché dans la crème anglaise. C'est pas facile de vous avouer en cet instant que nous sommes pas les vraies françaises. Ba-da-ba. partageons la joie partout où nous irons. Pourquoi pas suspendre votre incrédulité? Ça, c'est trop, trop, trop marrant.
That was Baby et Lulu avec Cette Nuit. Francophiles can find the YouTube link to that song on the Lulabelle's Francophiles website, or if you're a Spotify listener, head to my Lulabelle's Insta homepage and click on my link tree. There you will find a link to my Lulabelle's Frenchy Spotify playlist with all the podcast tunes in one place, as well as a few of my faves as recommendations as well. The link tree on my Insta page has links direct to my website and some other great links too, such as the France at Home link that I mentioned to Laura, the place where I bought online my exquisite Confiture Advent calendar this year. It's a great idea for a gift to cheer up your Francophile friends during this time, which is so difficult for so many. Who wouldn't love waking up each morning to a different petite confiture selection to go on a warm and crusty baguette? Now, for Francophilers interested in making their own confiture, I will place a recipe on the Lulabelle's Francophiles website also for a beautiful strawberry jam or confiture de fraise. It is actually surprisingly easy to make. In Australia, strawberries are everywhere in the stores at the moment, so grab a couple of punnets for this recipe. Then put the strawberries without stems and 120 grams of sugar into a pot. Mix them briefly and turn on the heat to low. The water comes out from the strawberries as soon as they start cooking over a low heat, and the pot will start to look quite juicy. Add thin round lemon slices from half a lemon and simmer some more over the low heat whilst skimming off the surface. The strawberries will boil down gradually, so you'll simmer then for about 20 minutes. And when it's cooled, the confiture will become a little bit thicker. Remove the lemon slices and, when cooled, transfer to a container or a bottle to keep. Et voila! Head to my website for the recipe link. And as I said before the song, to the lovely Laura Morelli, the links to her website and Insta page will also be there. So head to lulabellesfrancophiles.com for all the links from today's petit papotage under blog post 50. Alors, c'est tout et c'est la fin aujourd'hui. That is all for another Lulabelle's Francophiles episode. I am loving travelling vicariously with all of you, and today with Laura, she just made my heart sing. I hope you enjoyed it too. To be notified when new episodes are released, subscribe on your favourite podcast platform or follow Lulabelle's Francophiles on Insta, and head to the Lulabelle's Francophiles website as your place to stay connected to one of our fave destinations, France. Au revoir, mes amis. Bonne journée. Et à bientôt.